This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you think of the Amish, what comes to mind? Horses, buggies, long dresses and bonnets, long beards, no electricity? Well, yes, there is all of that. But there is so much more to the Amish in America and here in Michigan, from St. Joseph, Hillsdale, and Branch counties to the south to Mackinac County in the Upper Peninsula. The Amish population reaches nearly 11,000. We wanted to learn more about the Amish, especially what the rest of us might learn from them. Consider this. How does a one-room Amish schoolhouse going only to eighth grade with only a battery-powered clock in the way of technology, how do these schools turn out highly successful entrepreneurs, some of whose firms gross annual sales in the million-dollar range? I'm joined by Gertrude Enders Huntington, retired lecturer from the University of Michigan. She's the co-author of Amish Children, Education in the Family, School, and Community. And she joins us from her home in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. And we're also joined by Steve Nolte, professor of history at Goshen College in Indiana. He's the co-author of The Amish. It was the companion book to the American Experience documentary on PBS. Welcome to both of you. Trudy, when you were a grad student at Yale in the 1950s, you chose to do your dissertation on an Ohio Amish community. Why were you drawn to them?
Because everybody else was studying our plundered planet. Everything that people were doing wrong with the environment. And here were the Amish who were moving in often to farms that had been really worn down and building up the soil and having a positive effect on their environment. So I wanted to study how they did it and, more importantly, why they did that when their neighbors were acting differently.
And what was the reaction of your professors when you said, all right, I'm going to study the Amish?
Well, they were in favor because they knew they were going to die out, and they thought it'd be nice if I would document them before they died out. There were at the time about 30,000 Amish, and now they're about 280,000, so they didn't die out very well.
So clearly those professors were wrong. Steve Nolte, why has the Amish community grown as we've moved into the 21st century when we see doubling in number every 18 to 20 years? What's behind that?
Well, a couple things. One, obviously, is that the Amish have large families. Most families have six or seven children on average. Some families even have many more than that. But it's not just the large number of children. It's an increasing, we would say, retention rate. That is, an increasing percentage of the children of Amish parents choose to join the Amish church and follow the Amish way of life as adults. In the mid-20th century, perhaps 60% of Amish children chose to follow the Amish way of life as adults themselves. And today, it's about 85 or 90% of Amish children who do. And some of the reasons behind that, I think, include the rise of Amish schools, which is mostly a phenomenon of the second half of the 20th century. The first Amish school in Michigan started in 1956, and today almost all Amish children across the country attend Amish schools rather than public schools. So there's that kind of early formation and influence of Amish schools. And I think another one of the reasons actually has to do, and this surprises some people, but I think it has to do with change in the Amish community, particularly economic change. In the mid-20th century, it was really necessary to be a farmer, a successful farmer, to be a real member of the Amish community. And in the later 20th century, changing Amish economic patterns, there are now Amish folks who have their own small businesses, maybe work for other Amish businesses or work in non-Amish businesses. In other words, there are more economic possibilities. In some ways, it's easier to be Amish economically today than it was 50 or 60 years ago.
Trudy, tell us just who are the Amish. I get the sense it's a real mistake to think of them as one great big unified group. Is there a formal definition of Amish?
There is an informal sociological definition, and usually when we're talking about the Amish, we refer to those who still drive a horse and buggy rather than own and drive an automobile. But there are many different kinds of Amish, different varieties of Amish, and they are also related to the Mennonites, who have a whole range of strictness also.
One of the things that makes it challenging to generalize about the Amish is that as a church, and maybe we should clarify that, to be Amish is to be a member of the Amish church. There certainly are ethnic group components to the Amish experience, but it does at the end of the day come down to being a member of the Amish church. But the Amish church is very locally organized. There are no synods or dioceses or conferences. It doesn't parallel a lot of other denominations that many listeners may be familiar with in the Christian tradition. The 280,000 Amish people in the U.S. and Ontario comprise a little over 2,000 local Amish church groups, and each of those local churches has the authority, I guess we would say, to establish its own rules regarding technology and dress and a whole range of other issues. So it's not much of an exaggeration to say that there are actually 2,000 slightly different ways to be Amish today.
That was Steve Nold, who's a professor of history at Goshen College in Indiana, and he's co-author of the book, The Amish. We're also speaking with Gertrude Enders Huntington. Trudy is a retired lecturer from the University of Michigan and co-wrote the book, Amish Children, Education in the Family, School, and Community, as we look in the Amish in America and here in Michigan. And let's get into just how much the Amish reject modern technology. And Steve, you had a terrific quote in your book: had they simply rejected all things modern, they would surely have become a fossilized subculture. And we've certainly seen from what you've said that hasn't happened. How do they manage to reject modern technology all the while living in the 21st century and in many cases operating big successful businesses?
Well, most Amish communities use three different strategies all at the same time: acceptance, rejection, and modification when it comes to different sorts of technologies. And the more conservative settlements might use rejection more often than acceptance, and some of those on the more progressive end of the Amish scale might use acceptance more often than rejection, but all of them are using adaptation to some degree. Ways in which Amish families or Amish churches have chosen, for example, to draw a distinction between use and ownership, and might say, for example, well, it's fine to make use of a car. We're not going to own a car. If we own a car, then that gives us that gives us the ultimate control. We have, as an automobile, the name suggests, automatic mobility. We can choose when we want to go, where we want to go. So we won't own a car, but we may use a car. We may hire someone to drive us someplace. Some Amish communities have said, look, we're not going to have telephones in our homes, but an Amish business might be permitted to have a business phone that's not in the home but is part of the business. Some Amish contractors and roofers have cell phones that they use because when they're out on the job site, they need to be talking with subcontractors. Then there are some other very conservative Amish communities that they wouldn't be making those adaptations. They wouldn't have a telephone connection of any sort, for example, and they would be very slow to hire a driver to take them someplace. But in all of these communities, the question of what are we going to accept, what are we going to reject, and what are we going to adapt is an ongoing and lively conversation. There really aren't things that are completely off limits for discussion. These things are things that are continually being discussed and weighed.
Trudy, do we see, or as you study these Amish communities, if a family's uncomfortable with maybe the more progressive approach their community takes, do you see people picking up stakes and moving to one that perhaps is more conservative? Do you see that much?
Yes, that certainly does happen. They move both ways. Some move to more conservative ones, and some families move to more liberal Amish communities, depending on what they're interested in, what they believe in, and what they're willing to accept or put up with. I mean, there's been whole communities in Michigan, in southern Michigan, that moved away because they didn't want to be influenced by some of the more wild groups in northern Indiana, and they didn't want their young people. They wanted their young people to be more isolated.
Okay, those wild groups in Indiana. What about that? You know, and that leads me to want to talk about the education of children in the Amish community. And I want to double back to that question that I posed at the beginning of our conversation: how do you get such successful entrepreneurs out of schools that go only to the eighth grade, and they don't have any of that technology that the rest of us considers imperative to a good education. Trudy, what did you find as you researched your book?
Well, I found that the Amish are extremely adaptable. People think they're ossified peasants, but they're not. They're very adaptable. And a lot of them are very good with machines, and they're fascinated by things like cell phones and computers, and they do go to libraries. So they often do learn how to manage even things like the computers, which they can't have in their home, but they're not forbidden to use in a place, most of them in a place like the library. Again, it's hard to generalize because there's such a range as to what they allow and what they don't allow. So it depends on which ones you talk to. But children in the Amish schools learn hard work. They learn to be diligent. And they also, I think, get a kind of confidence that they can try anything, even though they supposedly end their education in eighth grade. The attitude is that you keep on learning. That gives you the basis from which you can go and learn the specialty that you need or want.
Yeah, I think that's really one of the key features is that schooling may end with eighth grade, but education certainly doesn't end with eighth grade. And the what we might talk about in formal terms as an apprenticeship, although the Amish don't really set them up as formal apprenticeships, but the idea that when one finishes eighth grade, you go to work in a family business, family farm, a neighbor's business, and Amish teens at age 17, 18 have a lot of responsibility, in some cases responsibilities for ordering supplies, negotiating contracts, making sure there's delivery of finished goods, sorts of things that many people, you know, in wider society don't have those opportunities until they are in middle management type settings when they're in their 30s or 40s.
Talk to us about what happens to the Amish boy or girl who wants to think of more formal education, even college. Is that at all accepted in the community, or does that pose problems?
It poses problems. On occasion, it's been permitted, but it has not really worked out. However, they do take correspondence courses. And they take, and in many communities, or in some communities, they take the GED so that they can work in factories.
I think one of the ways maybe to think about this is, do children in Amish homes ever go to high school or college? Occasionally they do. I think it's safe to say that if you are a 15-year-old and want to go to high school, if you're already thinking that differently than your parents at that age, there's really a very slim chance that you are interested in an Amish way of life as an adult. So the handful of Amish teens who go to high school or go to college are I think sort of destined not to be adult members of the Amish community. I mean, it's a bit like saying, you know, I want to live in North Dakota and I want to be a marine biologist. And at a certain point, you know, you're going to have to make a choice between one or the other of those things.
And one thing we should make clear, am I correct that children make a decision once they're adults whether they want to remain in the community?
That's right. The Amish Church practices baptism of adults, so you become a member of the Amish Church through baptism, but it's not the baptism of infants or even young children. Baptism is something that generally happens at the individual's discretion between the ages of usually 18 and 20, sometimes a bit earlier or a bit later, but generally the late teens. And so that's the point at which one would actually become a member of the Amish Church.
And do some of these young people take some time out, what the English might call a gap year, try life outside of the constraints of the Amish community?
Well, there are two authorities in Amish society, the family and the church. And in traditional rural society, often when one reached the age of 16, one came out somewhat from under the authority of the parents, had more free time, discretionary time, were able to maybe retain some of their wages if they were working away from home. So you do have this liminal space in the late teen years where children are no longer completely under the authority of their parents, and they have not yet, in most cases, join the church and come under the authority of the church. So there is this period of time in which those in their late teens are living a bit between family and church, and so they're able to do some things that when they were younger, their parents wouldn't let them do, and when they get older and join the church, they're not going to be able to do. And that range of activity also again varies quite a bit from community to community. Some of the things that Amish young people in that stage of life are doing might seem to the rest of us to be quite tame, like going to the mall or going to the movie theater. In other cases, it may include some fairly deviant behavior, underage drinking, buying a car, reckless driving. So there really are a range of things. It's not the case, though, that every Amish person between the ages of 16 and 18 just goes wild by any means, although there have been some television documentaries that unfortunately give that impression. But it is the case across the board that there is this period of time in the teens when children in Amish homes are somewhat betwixt and between the two major authorities in their lives.
Finally, I'd like your thoughts, Trudy, as you began your study in your grad work in the 1950s, you were talking to me about how the public was very much against, and they were very resistant to the Amish for a myriad of reasons. But today, the public is very entranced by all things Amish, even as branding. That's something that it's got a lure. What is it about the Amish, do you think, that has us so entranced and interested in them today?
I think there are many things. I think one thing is their family life, the fact that they do hold on to their children. But I think also we imagine them as our grandparents or as living an ideal life. And there's such an emphasis on individualism in our contemporary culture that I think we are nostalgic about the importance of community and social responsibility, which, of course, the Amish feel very strongly, and they're very supportive of one another. And I think that's something else that appeals to us.
That was Gertrude Enders Huntington, retired lecturer from the University of Michigan and the co-author of Amish Children, Education in the Family, School, and Community. She spoke to us from her home in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. And we've also been speaking with Steve Nold, who's a professor of history at Goshen College in Indiana. He also co-wrote The Amish, which was the companion book to the American Experience documentary on PBS. You've both given us new insights, and thank you so much for your time and for sharing with us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.